And what I did write is I do a lot of mindset work. So I was seeing an NLP practitioner to help with my sports mindset. And I did a lot of timeline therapy with her. I don't know, handful of sessions, 4 or 5 sessions. And those really, really helped. And also I work with a technique called Psych-K, which similar to NLP helps you to reprogram your beliefs at the subconscious level. And I'm constantly reprogramming beliefs around my sports mindset and my ability and the things that I'm doing, whether it's running or kickboxing. So I think I'm constantly doing work on my mindset. But there's a thing you have to do kind of even before that, which is to realize you choose what kind of experience you're going to have. Like, do you believe that it's going to be a sufferfest no matter what? Or are you open to the possibility of it not being a sufferfest? Like, are you open to the possibility of enjoying this endurance event? Because it is possible. It is possible to not like suffer through the whole thing or suffer through parts of it. It is possible to really enjoy the experience.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Holly Wharton. Holly is a trail runner, she's a hiker, and a lover of nature. Her podcast, Into the Woods, is about getting outside, getting into nature as a way to deepen your connection with who you are. She has skills in woodcraft and bushcraft, and she's a prolific author. She's also a coach. I hope you enjoy listening in on my conversation with Holly Wharton. Well, Holly, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for being here. I wanted to give you a chance to tell your story. I mean, you've got a lot of stories. I mean, as an author, I know you're like me, love to tell stories. What I kind of like to ask is, where you are now. I mean, you're doing all kinds of things. You know, you're out in nature, you're hiking, you're doing ultramarathon running. You're a writer, you're a coach, when you were in school, what was your kind of a beliefs about yourself and what you thought your life was going to be like?
I thought I was going to be a teacher. I mean,
traditional teacher, like in the classroom. Okay.
Yeah. I was an English major, Spanish minor. I thought I'd grow up to be some kind of either English teacher or Spanish teacher or something like that. And then my life completely veered off into unknown directions, unexpected directions.
So were you, did you have kind of a confidence about what your life was going to be like, you know, and you were all, like, this is great. This is what I'm going to do. Or were you, what was kind of going on inside?
I was never one of those people that like knew I wanted to like be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that from a very young age. Like I never had like a clear dream that I was fixed on. It was kind of like, well, I like these things. I like reading. I like writing. I like Spanish. I'll probably end up doing one of these things. And so I went to grad school at UCLA. I was working towards my degree in Spanish. And then I studied abroad in Mexico, and that kind of changed the course of my life. I don't think I had a clear plan. It was just.
Yeah. Well, that happens to a lot of us. I know. So were you athletic in high school, in school? And I don't think they don't, it's not high school there. It's.
I grew up in California. So.
California. Oh, okay. I did not realize that. I thought you were native of England.
No. Oh,
goodness. Okay. So you did do high school. So did you do athletics there?
No, I was not athletic at all. I hated PE. I was terrible at sports. I was the kid that got picked last for the teams. PE was such a source of shame for me as a kid. I was just awkward and awful. And I have bad memories of PE. My parents never forced me to do a sport from childhood. I just grew up thinking I was bad at sports. I just thought I got the smart gene. I did well in school, but I didn't get the sporty gene. And no one in high school or even earlier, no PE teacher ever taught me that if I just worked at it and tried and practiced, I could get better. Like, I literally thought I just wasn't born with the right sports gene, and so I was just doomed to be terrible at it. And it wasn't until my late 20s when I started running that I realized I could be athletic. But it took me many, many years to finally get to the point where I was like, oh, I can barely run for 2 minutes, but if I do it every day, then I can run for 3, 4, 5, half hour and beyond. You know, it makes me really angry because I feel like PE isn't teaching kids how to be athletic, because not everyone's naturally athletic, you know, right. And no one's training you the way adults train.
Well, and it's interesting that PE teachers, I mean, that seems to be a lot of coaches. I mean, they take, you know, they look at the natural athletes and they work with those people. Yeah. And there's not a, there's not this culture to say, you know, here's step by step. Yeah, sure. You know, you can't run half a lap around the track, you know, and you're having to walk. You know, they don't encourage you to, and well, that's the case in, I think, a lot of our education. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of grew up that way. I kind of thought, well, you know, if that's not my thing, this, you know, it's like, I'm not good at that. And so I didn't ever get that drive to say, okay, if I just do a small improvement in whatever area of my life, I can do amazing things. Yeah. You know, it didn't happen until much later. But so, when you started running, what kind of sparked that? It's like, you know, especially not being athletic, what's it?
Well, I was living a very sedentary life. I was working long hours on the computer. I had a lot of stress. And for the first time in my life, I gained like 5 pounds. Like, it wasn't a big deal, but I always thought I was like immune to weight gain because I'd never had a great metabolism. I could eat whatever I wanted. And then my life just got very stressful and I gained a little bit of weight. And I thought, what do I do? So I emailed a friend of mine from high school, my friend Amy, who was very athletic. And she was on the swim team. She was a runner. She did all kinds of things. And I said, Amy, what do I do? And she said, you go out and you buy yourself a pair of running shoes and you start running. And I was like, but I can't run. And she said, that's fine. You go out for half an hour. If you can only run for a minute, you run for a minute and then you walk for a minute. And then you try to run again for a minute and then you walk for a minute. And you just keep doing it for half an hour. And then you go out the next day and you do as best as you can. And so I started with that and I just kept running more and more and longer and getting better. And it was just, it was like this source of just, like, I couldn't believe how, I mean, it wasn't easy, but I improved the more I did it. Like, now it's just obvious that that's the way it works. But because I grew up with that idea that I just wasn't athletic, it was just amazing to me that I could be athletic. So that's what started it.
that's interesting. So what you were just kind of running for the exercise and to, you know, to give weight loss?
Yeah, that was the original thing. But then I realized that it helped with stress because my life was very stressful at the time. It was the only time in the day that I had kind of alone time where I could like be with myself and do my thing. It became a really important part of each day and really life-changing.
So did you kind of went from, you know, getting comfortable with running. So now you're running ultra marathons. I mean, there's a lot more, I think, to the story, but so you started, what kind of, where'd you go from there?
Well, it was a rocky road. So when I started running, I was like, well, what about a marathon? That's what people run, isn't it?
That's usually how it starts. It's like, oh, well, I mean, some people have, you know, they go like, well, I can do a 5K, you know, but a lot of times that, you know, that's the marathon is kind of the distance that everybody's like, that's the thing.
Yeah, that's the thing. I didn't even think about the other distances. That was just what I thought was done. So I signed up for a marathon and it was about 6 months to the day from the day I started running to the day of the marathon.
Oh my goodness.
Because this is how I function.
and I know, you know, you're not alone. There's a segment of people who kind of have that same kind of path.
It did not go well.
Yeah.
It was a great goal. I downloaded a training plan from online. This was back in the, I don't know, late 90s or early 2000s, probably, so we didn't have all the online resources that we do today. Downloaded a plan, worked toward the plan, felt like I was on track. And then my mindset just didn't help. I was at the back of the pack, which is fine. But it got to the point where I was the last runner. And this was an urban marathon. And at the end of the pack, behind me, was this ambulance that was like cutting off the traffic from the race. They were like marking the end of the race. And they were right on my heels. And I was running. And I remember there were, I didn't expect this. It was full of people like cheering me on. It was amazing. Like I loved that, you know, because I was used to my trainings, like running down this kind of quiet road, didn't have that. It was great. But then at the same time, I had this stupid ambulance right on my heels. And it was just really stressful. And I couldn't do it. And I started thinking, oh, well, maybe I can't do it. And then I started walking and then I tried to run again. And then it was just a downward spiral into quit. And that really messed up with my mindset for many years. And after that, I kind of went back to running on the treadmill at the gym, and it was like on and off, and I liked it, but I didn't feel confident about it. And I kind of stopped running for years. I come back to it every once in a while, but I mostly just quit. And then it wasn't until COVID that I got back into running again.
Because,
Yeah. So I had gotten into kickboxing, still doing kickboxing, and that was my main source of exercise for years. But then because of COVID, we couldn't have in-person exercise classes, and the online classes just weren't working for me because I live in a very small house, and the only place where I would have room to do kickboxing would be in my husband's office, and he was working, so it was So I got back into running because I thought, well, I can't just sit on the couch for whoever knows how long this is going to last. And I got back into running. And then we started watching all of these YouTube videos about ultra marathon runners. And I thought, wow, this is so amazing that these people can do this. Look at them run so far. I wish I could do that. And then I thought, I wonder if I could do that. And then that led to me signing up to a race and, you know, doing my first races. So,
So in your marathon, how far did you get before you decided?
I don't remember because this was 1,000 years ago, but it was, I got more than halfway, but I don't remember how far.
Well, with only 6 months of training, that would be an additional, you know, additionally hard, but.
And it was from zero to marathon. It was even from like a base level.
That's a pretty ambitious goal, especially if you're starting from not having ever run before, or not, you know, not being very athletic. That's kind of cool. So, you were doing more than just running, in those in between times. You were out hiking. You weren't just sedentary.
No.
So, okay. Yeah. So what was the, you know, what was kind of, you went from a runner to a hiker. What was your,
I got into like hiking and walking when I moved here to England. I went to this bookstore one day and I found this book that was like 52 walks near London. And I thought, oh, I'll check that out. And I just started going on these walks. And then I moved out to the countryside where I live now. And I live in an area that just has such a wealth of trails. Any direction that I walk outside of my town, I can reach a trail in less than 10 minutes.
Wow.
In any direction. Like there's so many trails. It's just absolutely fantastic. And so I just started exploring and walking. And then I started doing some of the longer distance trails here, like the national trails. And then I did the coast to coast this year. And I loved it. So I was constantly walking or hiking. And then before I got back into running.
Okay. Well, and not only that, I think you were, you kind of took some interest in nature and being out in nature as well.
Yeah.
So was that kind of part of that whole experience of moving to the country and
it was being out there? It wasn't the reason why we moved here, but once we did, I realized I feel really safe on my own on the trails. Like I don't feel like there are dangerous people around. I mean, obviously things happen every once in a while, but generally it's safe for a woman to be alone on the trails. We don't have any dangerous animals, no bears, no mountain lions, none of that. I think the most dangerous animal we have here is the cow. Because a lot of footpaths go through farmers' fields. So five or six people do die every year from cows, but
And they're, you know, especially a bull, if it's a bull, they tend to be protective.
Thankfully there's always a sign if there's a bull in the field, but
So do people die from regular cows as well?
They do. Usually it's dog walkers who won't release their dog. So a dog obviously can run faster than you. If the dog is stressing out the cattle, the tip is let go of the leash and let the dog run, because the cows are interested in the dog, not you. But a lot of people don't, and they just hold on to the dog and they're like running with the dog. And obviously they can't run as fast as the dog because of the cows, you know.
Right. Well, and I could see, I mean, I was in a place, so I was trying to help somebody get cattle back into their fence, and was, you know, the herd was stampeding, and I realized I'm standing in the middle of this field and this is not a good, I made enough noise that they turned, but I thought, okay, I could see a person, you know, cattle being afraid of something else and running over somebody.
Absolutely.
You know, especially a big herd. They're big. Yeah. And when they all get to going one direction, there's, you know, they kind of don't pay much attention to anything else except running away from whatever they're running from. So that's cool. You were spending time out on the trails. I know you've gotten, you know, kind of an interest in nature. Was that something that was from being out in the trails, or was it something you've always had kind of an interest in? Because I know you talk a lot about the effect of being out, what you're doing, you know, being out on the trail and walking, and how that kind of rejuvenates your soul.
Yeah, it does. I think I've always been interested in nature. We had a big garden, big backyard, big front yard when I was a kid. So I spent a lot of time outdoors. My parents grew their own vegetables, so I was always kind of out there, set up my own flower garden when I was like 14. My first job was at a garden center, so I was working with plants. And I lived right down the street from a state park, so I was always kind of dragging my friends up hiking on the summers. So I always liked being outdoors, I always liked nature, but it really wasn't until I moved to England that I started kind of consciously spending more time outdoors on the trails. So it was a big shift for me.
Yeah. So what is the, I mean, what kind of give me an idea of what you're, what you get from being out there? How's your response? What is your approach to being out there?
Well, it depends on what I'm doing, you know, cause I'm hiker, backpacker, runner. But I love getting outdoors. I love getting on the trails, and I love even spending time just being still in nature. So sometimes I go for a walk and I'll go into the woods near my house and I'll just sit next to a tree and just relax and kind of calm down. And I find it really good for stress reduction, for reconnecting with myself. I can do some journaling sometimes. There's just something really calming and also revitalizing about being in the outdoors. It's like it calms me and also energizes me at the same time.
And I know that there've been studies, of course, I mean, there's studies about everything and you can kind of find studies different, but there are scientific studies of people who spend time in nature that, you know, that it actually just being out in the woods reduces your stress, you know, just by the fact of walking out there and just spending a few minutes in that. So,
Well, the trees do release chemicals that can scientifically help with stress reduction.
Okay. Yeah. And that was part of the study that I missed, I've noticed that. I mean, just the time, and I spent, you know, a lot of years, you know, I had a love for it as a child, you know, but then, you know, life comes and I spent so much time in the city and just didn't get out. And, it was like, I always had a dream. You know, I appreciated it, but I just didn't do it until I started running trails. And and now it's like, if I don't get that every once in a while, I need to get out and connect. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you've written several books as well. So, you know, talk a little bit about what inspired you to start writing. I know you do coaching and podcasting, but you're an author. What inspired the books?
Well, I love reading other people's books about walking long distance trails. And in the winter, when I don't necessarily feel like spending too much time outdoors, I'll tend to read more books about being outdoors.
doesn't quite have the same effect, does it?
It doesn't, but it kind of gives me ideas for planning for the season and upcoming season and things like that. But I really just wanted to kind of contribute to that. And I wanted to share my experiences of being outdoors and what I do outdoors and inspire other people to do the same. And I just love getting feedback from readers. I mean, I had this one guy who got in touch who had read one of my books about the South Downs Way, which is the first long distance trail I walked here. And he came over from the States to walk that trail, loved it, and then decided to walk the Camino in Spain. So, you know, I love the fact that by sharing my story, it's inspiring other people to give it a go. Because when I first started walking these long distance trails, I was new, I didn't know what I was doing. And so I share all of those things. So that other people can avoid my mistakes.
So what were some of the challenges you faced when you started doing the long distance?
Well, I went from doing day hikes with a very small backpack, a day pack, to carrying a bigger backpack with more things. And of course, it was heavier. It was harder on the feet. It was more of an effort to hike with the extra weight. And, you know, I didn't do that part of my training properly. It was a big jump from just day hikes to a week-long hike. So that's one thing. And then just blister management. And I think that's a thing that any hiker, backpacker, runner learns what works best for them. But in the beginning, I really wasn't good with blister management and knowing how to take care of my feet.
Yeah, the feet are an important part. And that is for runners as well as hikers. So how much weight did you carry?
Well, not that much in the beginning because I was staying at B&Bs, so it wasn't a massive backpack, but it was a 36-liter backpack compared to my usual, like, 18 liters. So it was twice as much as usual, and I was carrying a lot of water. And the very first national trail that I hiked was during the summer. We had really high temperatures, not as high as this year, but almost. And so I was carrying 4 liters of water a day sometimes because I didn't have access to water on the trail. And so that alone is 4 kilos, so... You know, it was a lot more weight than I was used to.
So the national trail, you can stay at B&Bs along the way, similar to the Camino.
So usually they're not often, the trail doesn't often go through a village, but it'll be close to a village. So less than a mile off the trail, you can just kind of head down and stay somewhere.
Yeah, I just did a presentation for a business group that I'm in about the trails in the United States, the Appalachian Trail and the Triple Crown. And there are, especially the ones out west, they're very remote, and so you don't have the option of staying at a B&B very often. I mean, it's kind of a rare treat. And same way with the Appalachian Trail, most of it's just camping. So, but you've also done some practice in bushcraft about of camping out. So, what was was that something that you knew all along, or was that something you did when you started hiking?
And no, that was something when I started hiking and I started spending more time out on the trails, I realized I wanted to learn more about the stuff that I was seeing. So I found this really great school in my area called the Woodcraft School, and they do classes on plant identification and use. I did a 7-month ethnobotany course with them, and that was really great because I learned not only how to identify all the plants that I was seeing on the side of the trail, but how they can be used for different things. And then I got into bushcraft courses just to kind of learn how to survive and how to function in the outdoors without, you know, all the basic comforts that we usually have. So I found those to kind of, they kind of add to my experience in terms of, you know, being out on the trail. I also took some wildlife tracking and trailing courses with them. And that was also useful because when I see animal signs on the trail, I know now, you know, if there's a dead bird or something, I can tell, was that killed by another bird or was that killed by a mammal? And, you know, if I see a animal burrow, I can identify whether that's a badger or a fox or a rabbit or, I don't know, it's just interesting, you know, because you see these things as you're running on a trail. And now I know what they are, or who was there, or who caused them, or who lives there.
Tracking was something I would, when I was in grade school, opportunity to start looking at tracks in the mud. And so that's something I've always, I've done it. I never have taken any training, but, learning to kind of read the signs and identify what the tracks are and, kind of how old they are. It's fun. I enjoy it.
It is. But,
So have you done any of your survival type, you know, was that part of your training, is to go out and to live off the land for a while?
No, not yet. I did do a level 3 bushcraft course, which taught us kind of the basics. And it's the level 4 where you actually go out and kind of have to do some overnight things on your own. And that's something I do want to do sometime in the future when I've got time.
So are there a lot of edible plants? I mean, most of the time I'm like walking along through the forest and see a lot of plants. And I'm thinking at one point, we were living off of the plants that were here. So are there a lot of edible plants?
There are. Not a lot of them are palatable to the modern person's taste buds, because I feel like a lot of the plants that we eat that we buy at the grocery store have been kind of mellowed down in flavor. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the wild plants are really have a strong flavor, which I think is an acquired taste, which you can reacquire from eating them. But a lot of them are quite strong in flavor. And so you might want to cook them before you eat them raw.
Well, there's a plant that's similar to a nettle that grows along our and I think it was called a Canadian nettle, but it doesn't have the stickers on it. And, I was picking those and chewing on them. They were actually quite tasty. And one of the advantages is that they help reduce inflammation. And so as I was going through there, it was like, oh, you know, I'm getting a little few aches and pains. Let's take a handful of these leaves. And it could have been the placebo effect, but I don't know that I want to live on them all my life, but they were not bad.
Yeah. Well, stinging nettle is also edible, but of course you want to cook it first.
Yes.
You can use it to make soups and things, and they're quite tasty. Also good in a tea.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cause there are places, I mean, you know, when you've gotten into a bunch of stinging nettles, I mean, they're grow alongside the trail here, and in the summertime we're, it's like, yeah. If it's overgrown, you don't go down that trail.
Yeah. I'd never seen those in California. I don't know if we don't have them, but we certainly didn't have them in the area that I grew up in. And I never saw those before I moved to England. And the first time I touched one, I was like, oh, now I know what that is.
Well, I've traveled to California and out west, and I don't see them out west either. I think they're, has to be the deciduous trees, that kind of climate. And so, so yeah, I know they grow in England, and yes, you will definitely remember when you.
But I find that the first time I get stung each season is the worst, and then after that, if I keep getting stung, the after effect seems to last less. So I don't know whether my body gets used to it or what.
Yeah, I don't imagine you can develop a kind of a tolerance. I mean, imagine the people who lived on the nettles in centuries past didn't necessarily have rubber gloves and those types of things. You know, maybe they could have used animal skins or something to protect their hands. But that's something I still want to try. I may go out later this week and harvest some and try sauteing them up because I love greens.
Yeah.
So, in your long distance hikes, you did the several around England. Do you have any that are you're looking forward to that you'd like to do? Any on your bucket list?
Yeah, I have such a long bucket list. I've always wanted to do the Camino de Santiago in Spain. Mm-hmm. So that's probably number one on my bucket list. And I know there are many different Caminos, and I'm not sure which one I would do first. A couple of years ago, during COVID year, I planned to do the Camino Portugués, which goes through Portugal up to Santiago. And didn't do it because COVID kind of exploded right around the time that I was supposed to fly out there. So that's definitely on my list.
Yeah, I know you've got a podcast as well, and you had a guest that talked about doing the Camino. I think it was a recent guest even.
Yeah. But,
I just had someone talk to me about the Camino. My sister's boyfriend did it, and he has kind of put this idea bug in my head to hike it barefoot.
Oh.
And, cause I had a sandal rubbing on my heel, when we were hiking in Vail, just hiking up the mountain. And so I just took my sandals off and walked barefoot. And so, several people made comments, and my So my sister's boyfriend was like, well, you should be barefoot, man. You should go. And he says, you could go do the Camino. You know, people would recognize you as barefoot, man. I'm like, that's not exactly the reason to go hike that. But so yeah, it's an idea I've been kicking around. I've been watching some of the videos. And
wow. I look forward to hearing how that goes. Because I know people do it. I've seen people hike the Three Peaks here barefoot, and it's, uh-huh. You know, it's doable.
Yeah, it's doable. I love the feeling of barefoot. I mean, I started running in sandals. You know, I run barefoot, but usually it's on streets, you know, not, mm-hmm. not on gravel. So, mm-hmm. you know, I like the bare dirt. I mean, if the trails has bare dirt and not a lot of gravel, yeah. You know, barefoot's great for hiking. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not so much for running.
Yeah,
that's cool. So besides the Camino, anything else you've ever thought about doing trails in the United States?
I would love to. Obviously, that would require more time, more of an investment of time. I don't know if I have enough time to take out of my life to do that. But the Pacific Crest Trail is something that's always kind of called for me, mm-hmm. called to me, because I grew up in California, and a big chunk of that trail goes through California, and it would just be really, really lovely to do that. But yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, that's great. So, You interview a lot of people on your podcast. You know, talk. How did you get into podcasting?
Well, my podcast originally started out as a business podcast. Back when was that? 9 years ago? Yeah, almost exactly 9 years ago. Actually, I think it was the 12th of August of 2013 that I released my first episode. And I, at the time, I was listening to podcasts, and I was listening to a lot of business podcasts, and I couldn't find any podcasts that just featured women, like women talking about their stories of podcasting. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, I can't find what I want. I started asking around to people. They couldn't recommend anything to me. And I thought, well, I guess I'm gonna have to start my own. And I never thought I'd still be doing it 9 years later. And of course, it's changed from the business podcast into an outdoors podcast. But kind of the underlying theme has always been around personal growth and personal development through business or through outdoor adventures. So yeah, I love it.
If you are a business owner or an entrepreneur, you know all about stress. Business owners and ultramarathon runners both have to have a strong mindset, but the difference is that business owners and entrepreneurs tend to ignore the warning signs of stress and burnout. When you run an ultramarathon, you push your body to the limit, and you have to manage your energy in an ultramarathon to be successful and make it to the finish line. But when you run an ultramarathon, you get to rest and recover when your race is over. If you're a business owner, you tend to feel like you're in a race with no finish line. In ultramarathon, they call those the last man standing, and you, the strongest, survive. If you're a business owner and you're not careful, you could be one of those who ends up blowing up and not finishing, breaking your body. Business owners tend to keep pushing until something breaks. As a mindset coach, I help business owners manage their energy, de-stress their life, and be profitable as well as healthy and successful. If you are in that situation, contact me at ultramindsetpodcast.run. That's ultramindsetpodcast.run for a free 25-minute mindset reset. I can help you keep from burning yourself out, managing your energy for success. So what has been your kind of story of personal growth through all this? I mean, from not being an athlete and then doing all of these things, what, you know, kind of what changes have you seen in your life as a result of that?
Well, really, more than anything, I think it's been an expansion of what I think is possible for me or what I'm capable of achieving. Because, you know, I went from being the kid that gets picked last for teams to now running ultramarathons, and it's like, I have a much broader view or opinion or vision of what I'm capable of doing in other areas of my life. I mean, the fact that, you know, I was away from kickboxing for a couple of years, because then also I got a shoulder injury last year, so I couldn't do it. and started doing ultra marathons, ran some ultra marathons, and now I'm back to kickboxing. It's like I've expanded my vision of what I'm capable of in kickboxing. You know, I'm hoping to do my black belt grading at the end of this year. So I've been doing a lot of extra sparring sessions, and they're really challenging because my teacher knows I'm training for my black belt, and so he's really pushing me. But I'm much better at handling those challenging sparring sessions because I know I can run ultra marathons. It's not a linear thing, but it's like I can do this really hard thing, this really challenging thing, which is, you know, running 100K. So why can't I be good at kickboxing and, you know, get my black belt grading? The advanced gradings in my school are quite long. They're 5 hours on a Saturday, 8 hours on a Sunday. And I always approach them as this thing I had to do to like get to the next level and this thing I had to suffer through. And I didn't really look forward to them. And I always kind of felt like I was suffering through them. But now I've realized it's like an endurance event. I mean, it's not as long as running an ultra marathon, but it's like an endurance event, different because it's kickboxing, but I'm approaching it with a very different attitude. It's like, how exciting. I get to do this thing for 5 hours on Saturday and 8 hours on Sunday, and it's going to be really challenging. And I'm, you know, going to be pushed beyond my limits or what I think my limits are, but I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward to seeing how I perform rather than thinking, oh, I have to suffer through this thing just to get my next belt. So it's been a huge mindset shift for me.
So how can other people do that? Because typically, I hear runners in ultra marathons. I mean, it's a suffer fest. I mean, and they use those words, you know, for describing what they're doing. I mean, they still do it. Yeah. And at some level, I think, you know, there's a motivation to test themselves.
Yeah.
But you can test yourself without making yourself miserable. Yeah. So where's the difference? I mean, how can people change that perspective?
I think that's a great question. And when I did my 100K, I was shocked that I didn't suffer. Mm-hmm. Like the longest I'd run before the 100K was like 57K. And that was a training run. And the entire day, I loved it. I was a slow runner. I finished in 17 hours and 32 minutes. The cutoff was 18 hours, so I was kind of right there.
I can identify.
Yeah. Back of the pack runner. But I loved it. I loved every minute of it, even though it was challenging. I never had any low points. I never had any like downward spirals. And I was shocked. And I really kind of spent some time going back over like, what did I do right to prepare for this? And what I did right is I do a lot of mindset work. So I was seeing an NLP practitioner to help with my sports mindset. And I did a lot of timeline therapy with her. I don't know, handful of sessions, 4 or 5 sessions. And those really, really helped. And also I work with a technique called Psych-K, which similar to NLP helps you to reprogram your beliefs at the subconscious level. And I'm constantly reprogramming beliefs around my sports mindset and my ability and the things that I'm doing, whether it's running or kickboxing. So I think I'm constantly doing work on my mindset. But there's a thing you have to do kind of even before that, which is to realize you choose what kind of experience you're going to have. Like, do you believe that it's going to be a suffer fest no matter what? Or are you open to the possibility of it not being a suffer fest? Like, are you open to the possibility of enjoying this endurance event? Because it is possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is possible to not like suffer through the whole thing or suffer through parts of it. It is possible to really enjoy the experience.
So it's interesting you talk about, you know, the mindset work that you're doing. A lot of runners, I know, this is my podcast is primarily toward ultra marathon runners or people who are looking to run. But a lot of runners that I talk to, they think that just whatever training that they're doing on the trails is sufficient for mindset. No. And there's no you know separate mindset work that goes along with running. So you're working on your mindset and said that actually helped you to enjoy that. How could other runners kind of look at, well, maybe I should do something different with, you know, think about my mindset separately from my running.
So I would work with someone else, especially in the beginning, because it helps to have an external mindset coach or person to help you with this. And then it gets easier, like once you start paying attention to the stuff that's coming up for you. So every time I would go out for a run when I was training, I would pay attention to what was going on in my head. I would pay attention to those not nice little thoughts that you get sometimes. You're like, oh, I'm a terrible runner. I'm so slow. I'm so awful. I'm never going to do this. I'm never going to, like, pay attention to all the negative mind chatter. And then I would just write it down. I would make a list at the end of a run, like what came up for me, all the negative stuff. And then you want to flip that on its head and think, well, what do I need to, what do I want instead? What do I need to believe to enjoy this training run, to enjoy my race, to finish my race, to finish my race in the time that I want to? Like, what do I need to believe about myself? Who do I need to be in my head to have the experience I want to have? And it really, it's that in itself is a huge mindset change, because a lot of people kind of sweep those negative beliefs under the rug and think, oh, well, I'll just pretend they're not there and they'll go away. But if you can train yourself to pay attention to them, and then do some work either with a coach or with, you know, to shift them, that makes a massive shift in your mindset and what you believe is possible.
I think that what you said, pay attention, because from my experience and, you know, also being, you know, seeing how other people respond, I think we're so used to the negative voice in our head that it sounds normal. I mean, it feels normal. It feels just that there's a habit of that negative self-talk, and we don't even realize how negative it is, nor the effects that it has upon us. So how do you, I guess, you know, because the first part is awareness. How can you practice awareness?
So when you notice those thoughts coming up, pay attention to them. Don't just automatically dismiss them or try to replace them with something else. Like, pay attention to them. Let yourself. This is a fine line, because you don't want to go down the spiral, but also you do want to be aware of the stuff that's coming up for you, so you can kind of log it for later to work on it. So pay attention without getting too attached to them and ending up in that downward spiral of negativity. Again, it's a trial and error in the beginning, and it's a delicate balance, and you're going to need to practice it. But, you know, I get to the point now where I can pay attention to a thought and notice it and then kind of bank it for later to work on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's not only the thoughts, because there are also feelings attached. Yeah. So every thought we have, there's a feeling. So, you know, oftentimes the thought is the trigger, but the feeling is the thing that really, really, makes or breaks what your mindset is.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the being aware of it, but also I think kind of all looking at the feeling. And so, you know, kind of saying, oh, this is helping, you know, kind of dragging me down. Sometimes, you know, yeah, I think that's a good thing. Kind of hearing something, being aware of it and starting to analyze what really is going on. And the idea of going into it saying, okay, I'm going to write this down when I'm done, you know, would help you kind of, would help you pay attention.
Yeah. And then once you write it down, then do that work to kind of flip it on its head and think, well, what do I want instead? What do I need to believe about myself?
Yeah. So, I mean, is it helpful or do anything to try to figure out where or why those things are coming up?
That's not the way I work. I mean, you can, and I think a lot of people work that way. I did find it really useful when I was working with someone else to kind of get to the root of why that DNF marathon really messed me up for so many years. And it was just that stress of having that ambulance right on my heels. And you know, that just really triggered the downward spiral. So it wasn't so much that, you know, I was a bad runner or I was a slow runner, or I was the end of the pack. It was that ambulance that would really trigger that downward spiral for me. So it was kind of an external thing. So it wasn't, I'm bad because I couldn't finish this race. It was, there were some factors that were, you know, not normal. So working with someone else can also help.
Yeah. And I would imagine, I'm just from a outside perspective, there could be some feelings of shame. I was like, you know, not only am I, you know, I could handle being the last runner, but there's this stupid ambulance. And so everybody knows, you know, everyone's looking at me that I, you know, they're waiting on me for the traffic to come through. And
It was, it was so stressful. I mean, it's not like a trail race where you've got like the sweeper who is some guy or woman running behind you. Like it was an ambulance with everything that an ambulance means. You know, ambulances are there to like save people who are dying and like having you know, major health problems. It really messed up my head.
Yeah. And that's, you know, my wife has asked me several times, because I have had been DFL in several races. And my wife keeps, she asks me often, doesn't it bother you that you're, you know, that, that everyone's waiting on you? Everyone's, they're waiting on you to go home. And I said, well, no, I mean, the cutoff time is there. And, you know, if I can make the cutoff time, then, you know, I'm good. Yep. And in the circles that I run, you know, people that I run with, you know, DFL is, you know, is almost a position of honor. It's like you finished, you know, you were out there and grounded out.
You were out there a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do run slow. And so, you know, I have, there are races now that I'm kind of looking at, I think, oh no, I'm not going to, I, the cutoff time is too short, you know, especially for some 100-mile races that I've looked at. I was like, oh, I can't, you know, I need a couple more hours than that. 30-hour cutoff is a little bit much for me. So,
I think that's another good thing too, is, and that's something that's helped me with other areas of my life, is to accept the fact that A, I'm a slow runner. Like, I'm not competing to win, certainly not. Like, and it's okay to be slow, and it's okay to be last. And like, that's okay, because everyone's different and you're doing the thing your way. And so that's also been an important learning for me from the whole ultramarathon running.
Well, and I'm starting to look at, okay, you know, I ran 100 miles. I've done 100 miles and, you know, made the cutoff. But, you know, that was a couple of years ago. And I'm running a little bit slower now than I was then. And so I'm working on trying to run faster. But if that doesn't work out for me, I'm going to have to choose, you know, a 36-hour race to do 100 miles. You know, so there's other options. You know, it's like, I still want to do that. I love the distance. Yeah. And I was like, okay, you know, I can run a loop for 36 hours, you know, it's like that, you know, or 33. I mean, I think that's what that'd be about, you know, a little over 32 hours is what I can do 100 miles in. And, I'm still, you know, I haven't given up. I'm still looking at a way to do that. So
good.
So you said, you know, talked about, the looking at the why, you know, a lot of psychoanalysts will, you know, spend a lot of time on the why of how people got to where they're at. And I think, you know, the difference you talked about working with an NLP practitioner and the mindset work is that, yeah, it's okay to be aware of that, but don't spend too much time there on what happened or why it was that way of like, well, let's see what we can do to change it and turn it around. And I think that was great. Any more on your bucket list, kind of looking ahead for where you want to go? I mean, what, you know, do you have any more books that you're going to write? Do you have other things looking ahead of what you want to accomplish?
Well, I hiked the coast to coast in, May of this year.
So what is the coast to coast?
Okay. So the coast to coast is one of the most popular trails here in Britain, and it goes from the West Coast to the East Coast.
Okay.
And it across kind of the most narrow point of Britain. And it passes through three national parks. So you get like a real variety of scenery. You've got the Lake District, which is in the west, which is just amazing fells and lakes, and it's just really wild and remote feeling. And then you go through the Yorkshire Dales National Park, which is just beautiful rolling hills and little streams, and it's just sheep everywhere. It's really lovely. And then you go through the North York Moors National Park, which is just open moorland, which is also really, really wild and just windswept. And it's like Wuthering Heights territory. It's constant wind, but also just really wild feeling. And so that was really, really lovely. And so I've got to write the book about that, because I did the trail and I backpacked and I camped along most of it. Stayed in a B&B one night just because we needed, you know, a bit of rest and bed, but camped the rest of the time. It was a great, great experience. So I want to share that with other people.
Okay.
And then as far as upcoming things, you know, there's always trails that I want to hike and run, but I also really want to do a 100-mile race.
Okay.
And hopefully that will be next year. There's a couple that I have my eye on that are quite near to where I live. The South Downs Way, which is the first national trail that I hiked. There's a North Downs Way 100-mile race and South Downs Way 100-mile race. And there's a North Downs Way 100-mile race. And that trail passes within 10 minutes of my house. And it's kind of my usual running ground. So I'd like to do one of those next year.
Next year. Okay.
Yeah. Well, the dates have passed for both of them. One of them was in April and the other one was just last weekend. So.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. That's, I've the 100-mile I was planning on for this year, I'm going to put off till next year as well. So.
I was supposed to do the one last weekend, but coming back to kickboxing and having this big goal of doing my black belt grading in December, it's been really hard for me to juggle two sports, and they're two very different sports. So while they do help each other, like my running fitness has certainly helped my kickboxing fitness, but it's hard to combine the training. So.
I can see that. I can imagine that. So, well, thank you a lot, Holly. Tell where people can find you.
My website is hollywharton.com, and that's Holly like the tree, WORTON.com. And I've got everything there. I've got my podcast. I've got links to my books, my blog. I've got like 11 years of content there.
So, and do you offer coaching as well?
I do, yes. So okay. I do mindset work for people, and I also offer regular coaching, both for book writing and book publishing and also for athletic stuff.
Okay. And you talk a little bit about your technique. I mean, you said it's similar to NLP. So kind of give a little bit about, how you work as a coach so people might know if it's a good fit for them.
So Psych-K is a technique that's super easy to use. Have someone fill out a form so I can get an idea of where they are, what their goals are, where they want to be headed, and what's the stuff that's coming up in the way. You know, what are they feeling like they're not good enough? It's too hard. They don't have enough time. And I help get clear on what is the mindset they need in order to achieve this goal and to do the training that they need to do to get there. And then I work on creating belief statements with them to program into their subconscious to help them along their way.
Okay. Okay. So it is actually helping people to program their subconscious.
Yes, it is. It is. We actually do the mindset work.
Okay. Yeah. Cause that's such a big thing because, there's a lot of what I have read about the subconscious. You know, they talk about the power of the subconscious and how much influence it has on it, but there are not very many people that talk about how to actually make your subconscious believe you, the subconscious is not really, antagonistic. It just believes without any kind of filter. And so those beliefs get lodged in there that were never analyzed. And then when you try to use analysis to change them, it's like they're already set. And I've read very few places that actually help people be effective at changing that. a good approach for people who to be able to do that. So, well, thank you a lot, Holly. I appreciate it. And before I let you go, I have a tradition called the bridge questions.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side, he see.
Ask me the questions, Bridgekeeper. I'm not afraid.
What is, as you, in your either hiking or running, besides shoes, most people, that's an essential, an essential piece of equipment that you would not ever give up?
Oh, it's my Salomon Advance 12 running vest. Oh, I love that vest so much. When I first started running, I had this really cheap running vest because I thought I wasn't good enough to deserve a nice expensive one. And it was terrible. It like never fit. And when I got the Salomon vest, it just, I love that vest so much. It's like, I put it on. It's like a part of my body.
Okay. So, why is it the fit or the convenience of what it'll hold?
Everything. It's the fit. It doesn't move. It feels like I said, it feels like it's a part of my body. It's got plenty of pockets and spaces for me to carry all the stuff I need. It's just convenience and just perfect.
Oh, cool. Question number two, what is the strangest thing that you've seen when you've been out in the woods?
Oh, the strangest thing I've seen. I was out with a friend and we were on a walk and we were in the middle of the woods and we saw these two trays of food. It was almost like airline trays where you've got like the different compartments and different things, but mm-hmm. It was like two trays of English breakfasts. One was half eaten, the other one wasn't, just in the middle of, on the side of the trail. It was very, very weird. Food.
That, yeah, that is. And can you kind of wonder, you know, what is the story? I mean, because
there, get there?
Yeah, there's a story, you know, there's a story behind that. Yeah. that's what makes the things that we find kind of strange. It's like, that's just, yeah, there's a story there that I'd love to hear sometime. So third question is, what is your a word or phrase that describes your philosophy of life?
Oh, just keep going, keep practicing, and work on your mindset. It gets better.
Great. Well, thank you a lot, Holly. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ultra Marathon Mindset Podcast. I do enjoy being able to spend time with you here each week. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. The show notes for this episode and others are at ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can find this week's guest there. More information, links to their social media and website. There's also a podcast player there if you want to share this episode with somebody who does not normally listen to podcasts and doesn't have a podcast player on their phone. You can also find links there for my Amazon affiliate link, Crush Your Goals course, a short course I made to help you get your goals in order. Also, you can schedule a chat with me. My online calendar is there. All of these links are at the sidebar if you're on a laptop, or you have to scroll clear to the bottom if you are on a phone. If you did enjoy this episode and you do know somebody who might like it, take it just a minute, send them a link so they can listen. Remember that an ultramarathon mindset is about more than just running. You need a strong mindset for success no matter what your goal in life. And developing a strong mindset is a skill you can improve. Thank you again for listening. I'll see you next time.